Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 28.
Verweet. We did it.
We made it. And thanks to all the listeners who listened to the whole journey of it, we made it all the way through slumber in New York.
It was sad and happy and sad and happy.
That it ended, you mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was like sad because I really enjoy watching this show. So I was sad that I was not going to be able to see it, you know, five times a week. But I was happy because I was really proud that we did it.
And tired of doing the dirty, bloody laundry.
And I was tired of doing the bloody laundry.
I'm really happy about how it all went down at the end. Like, I'm very proud of what we created. I'm so glad so many people came and saw it and talked to us and the feedback we got. And I'm so excited to do it in Australia. But I just can't say, you know, thank you to enough to those of you who listen to the podcast, who support us, who came and saw the show, who talked about it with us afterwards, and who've been a part of this journey with us, listening to us talk about, oh man, we're going to do a show, all the way through to, yep, last show in New York was yesterday, and now we're prepping for the tour.
Was it yesterday?
Two days ago, Sunday.
I was like, wait. But the best was we got another review.
We did, from Mona.
It might be the best review I've ever read of any show. It is amazing. And even our press agent was like, this is the best review I've ever read, and I've read a million reviews. It is by Mona. I wish I could remember her last name. But it's like pxp.tdf.org.
And you should read it.
But she loved the show, and she actually was like the audience participant poll that night. And Lee, our killer, was like, she had a clipboard. I don't know. I made her put it down because I pulled her up on stage. Like, I don't know what she was writing down. And much to our surprise, she wrote a review, and she's like my favorite person.
Yeah, it's really funny. I mean, I like it because she's also like 18 or 19, the girl who's reviewing it. She's got a really great young voice and fun and silly. And check out her little write-up about it.
Yeah.
And as we said last weekend, we were going to put out a 360 video, which we did a couple hours after we put out the podcast. So if you listen to the podcast but haven't seen it yet, you can go on YouTube or the Hideaway Facebook page and watch the opening scene of Slumber, the pillow fight dream sequence, as it were, in 360. So if you have it on your phone or you have Google Cardboard, you can sit in the audience in the front row and watch the Halloween weekend performance.
Yeah, it's a really cool thing.
It is a cool thing. And it's just a cool way to have it recorded, better than just the 2D
totally
screen version.
But this morning, before we voted,
woo-hoo!
We went to BK Live and did a live on TV, on screen.
On TV? I don't know, on air?
A live on air interview with me, Josh, and Olga Karmansky. Basically, we sat with these two dudes.
Greg and Brian.
Talked a little about Slumber. And then Olga did her contortion act. And the room was amazed. And that was a fun experience.
It was fun. I mean, that was our first time on live TV, right? At least my first time on live TV.
Yeah. I think that was my first time on live TV.
But it was fun. It was fun talking to them about Brooklyn, about the show. And we did tease a little bit about our upcoming virtual reality circus project.
Yes.
So go on YouTube, Google us, and you'll find out some more.
Oh, another thing we did as a cast was we went to Curious.
Oh, yeah. I forgot we went to Curious. Yeah, let's talk about that.
Randall's Island. Cirque du Soleil's Curious.
Which, you know, has, I mentioned it before, but has the most crazy trampoline act in it.
Yes. And Ryan Shinji did not disappoint.
No, had that Peter Pan spin he has on his Instagram.
It's just amazing. He gets they raise him up to the top of the tent, and then he lets go and does these crazy trampoline flips. And I knew he was like working on this Peter Pan trick where he looks like Peter Pan flying through the air, and I saw it and I screamed out, "Peter Pan!" And the ladies in front of me were like, "This bitch be crazy." They were like, "Why are you screaming that?" And I was like, "Ah."
Yeah, it was a cool experience seeing Curious because the last time you and I had seen it, as we've talked about before, was during previews.
Yeah.
So seeing it 2 years later was a really fun way to see the journey of the show. It got so much tighter than when we saw it originally.
Mm.
But still, a lot of the same cast, which is quite cool.
Yeah.
And gotta give a shout out to that standing cradle act.
Oh, they're
beautiful
great
in the beginning. For those who don't know what cradle is, it's a little tough to describe, but if you sort of imagine a guy standing on a platform with space between his legs, he sort of throws this girl the way one might do like dumbbell swinging exercises.
Kettlebell?
Kettlebell swinging.
Dumbbell?
Dumbbell.
That would be like a piece of poop that's a bell.
Kettlebell. Kettlebell exercises. But he basically does it with a girl, and then he just throws her super high, and she flips and, you know, gets caught by one arm or one foot or a twist. It's just it's a really beautiful number, and I recommend people see Curious while it's in New York, not here for much longer.
No, I think it's till the end of November.
And I think we're going to have Ryan on the podcast, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, and he can talk about what that show is like, what writing and creating that trampoline number was like.
He's an amazing athlete.
Really, really interesting dude. So yeah, I mean, now we're just sitting at home podcasting showless.
No,
what are we gonna talk about for the next couple of weeks? Yeah, we had a fun closing night party on Sunday where everybody came back to our place, including today's guest, Brett Pfister.
Yes.
And just had a really nice time. I'm already a little bit sad about it, but I'm excited for you guys to hear this episode. Brett is one of my longest, oldest friends, and I've known him from Circus Smircus when we were both kids together, and then hung out with him in London when I was there, and he comes to New York all the time, and he's a really interesting guest.
Yeah, I met him 3 years ago, I guess, when he was in New York doing La Soirée, and I saw him do his aerial hoop act, and I also saw him in Midnight Circus in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
Doing his... Actually, we saw him in Montreal with Midnight Circus, not Chicago.
I forgot we'd seen him there.
Yeah, and he also did his air loop. One of the few... I think, like, he's the first guest that we've talked to where from, like, 8 years old, they knew that they wanted to do circus.
Yeah.
Most people discovered it a little bit later in life through other things, but he just saw it and was like, this is what I'm doing.
I want to give a real brief summary about Brett's biography because we do spend a little bit of time talking about it, but I mostly just spend time talking to him about, you know, his experience and sort of his views on different things. But Brett, as Lindsay mentioned, was born in Vermont, went to Circus Mercus as a kid, graduated high school super early, sophomore year, went to one of the most elite training schools for circus in North America, which a few of our guests have talked about already, but listening to his experience talking about it, going through it at age 16 is quite interesting. And then after that, he sort of started working immediately. And Brett does this aerial hoop number that's very focused simultaneously on flexibility, but also like there's a lot of acrobatic tricks in it. And sort of the culmination of that number has really happened with this company, La Soirée, who he's been with for 9 years now. But aside from just being a performer, Brett's a particularly interesting artist in general. Aside from just performing his hoop number, Brett's been directing circus shows. He's currently doing a sort of stand-up comedy contortion act that we talk about a little bit. And my favorite part of the interview really comes near the end where we talk about gender in circus and particularly in aerials and how that sort of is playing out in the industry right now. So stay tuned for our interview with Brett Pfister.
And also, if you've been able to hear a little meow this whole time, that's my cat.
Hudson.
He just wants to make an appearance. But if you like the show, make sure to Facebook like us, Twitter tweet us, Instagram follow us, email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. But here is our interview with Mr. Brett Pfister.
So you're from Vermont originally, right?
Yep, I am. I grew up in extremely rural Vermont. So my intro to circus in general was through Smircus because...
How rural? Like, how big was your town?
Population, I have no idea how many people that was. But it's small. It's real small. Like, I my closest neighbor was, like, you get in the car to go to your neighbor's house.
Yeah.
You didn't walk there.
And did you see Smircus because it came to your town, or did you, like, how did you find it?
It came through Montpelier. I think my parents were just bringing my sister and I as kids, as, like, a fun summer activity.
Is your sister older or younger? It's Amanda. Is your sister's
Amanda. Yeah. Amanda Pfister.
Did your parents do that on purpose?
No.
Like, oh, crap.
No. And weirdly, they didn't get the joke, you know, through high school. Even me, through high school, like, Amanda Pfister's brother. And then only, like, years later, I was, like, I don't know, maybe, like, drinking with them one night. And I was, like, oh, my God, like, you named her Amanda. What the fuck? And they were, like... What does that mean? And I was like, oh, I don't want to explain it to you. That was really awkward.
She's
6 years older than me. So they were bringing, I think my mother tells me they were originally bringing her to the circus. Mm-hmm. And then I was there. And then she lost interest at some point around the time where I was like, this is amazing. I have to be part of this.
And so when did you like start training circus? Was that with like at Smirkus camp or something?
So apparently I'll not do that. I realize that now. How's this? Get some good, get some background.
Everyone enjoy the ice shaking.
Let me start that again. So, what was the question?
How did you start training?
All right. Thank you. Apparently at around 5 or 6 years old, I was saying to my mother, like, I want to be part of this show. Mm. I want to be all involved with this. But Smirkus camp, you can't start till you're 8, or at the time they have a younger one now. So she put me in gymnastics training as like a pre-training. So I did gymnastics like perhaps 5 till 9 years old, and then started Smirkus camp at 8, right when I could. So we had like a couple year overlap where I was doing Smirkus camp and gymnastics, and then quit gymnastics, just to focus on circus more, or not focus, but like as a kid, I was just like way more interested in like climbing on stuff than I was in like. Gymnastics is very like rigorously, you know, it's like do this. And I was like, I want to do whatever I want.
Were you having like a good time in high school and middle school? Or were you sort of like an outsider?
I was an outsider, I would say. Yeah. Yeah. I was an outsider. I don't know if you can relate to that maybe, but
oh, yeah, for sure.
I was just passionate about things that had nothing to do with school. So I guess I wasn't into the like school, like activities.
Right.
I want to do something else. Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't do theater in high school, or did you do theater in high school?
A very small touch, but not really, no.
Yeah. No, like no singing in your background?
No. I think I was maybe in the band for like 5 minutes.
You did the hand claps in the background.
They're like, okay, Brett.
So, but you went on Smirkus tour when you were really young, right?
Yes, I was 12. So I had done 4 years of camp. I did 8 through 12 and then gone young. And at the time already I was like, this just seems too late. Like I should have started already on tour. Cause I got on the second time I auditioned when I was 11 and then got in.
What did you audition doing when you were 11?
It was, I had been planning like an acrobatic thing by myself. And then like 2 weeks before, this high school friend of mine who was like vaguely interested in circus was like, oh, I'm gonna like, let's audition together. And me as a kid was like, yeah. It was amazing.
Team member.
Yeah. And then in retrospect, like when I didn't get in, I was like, I should have just stuck to my own thing because it ended up being like really thrown together last minute. Mm. So it's no shock. And also when I was 11, when I auditioned was the year that Smirkus took all of the Waldorf kids. And it was the year that Disney was filming. It was 99 Robin Hood.
Right.
And so I think if that huge, incredible Waldorf crew hadn't come in, I may have had more of a shot, but they took, I don't know, like, And it was the year they took all of the, they took 3 or maybe even 4 London or English kids.
Yeah.
Because Disney was doing it in co-filming with a UK company.
Probably a good thing that you weren't on the Disney reality show.
Why do you say that?
Yeah. I was on a Disney show.
Are you kidding? I would have loved that.
Oh, yeah. Because they filmed Circus Dreams, like the summer before I went on. And it's just so embarrassing. That's not so embarrassing, but everybody gets so embarrassed with like the 14-year-old version of themselves saying things.
I worked on as a coach when Circus Dreams. Is that, what was her name? That
I don't know. I was on tour when she made it.
Yes. But I was there working in some aspect, coaching perhaps. And actually, the whole time I was like, oh, wow, if I'd been on tour with all this, I would have loved it. I would have been like,
I would too.
Star.
It's like, they're like, feels like, over here, like, look at me, I'm part of this.
What did you audition with when you were 12?
Me and Abby Suskin. Her and I are very much Circus Mercus siblings because we started camp the same year at 8 and did 4 years of camp together, then auditioned together in 2000 and got in together. And we were 2 of 3 taken that year. It was her, myself, and Josh Shack were the only 3 taken that year. And
that's such a funny trio.
And it was. And Josh Shack, of course, had been at camp with us for a while. And also, then we were 4 who started that year because they took us 3, and then Tobin Rennick got in the year before and. I want to say broke his elbow or had some sort of injury just before tour started, so didn't do it, and then came back in 2000. So the 4 of us started in 2000.
What was your audition?
It was like a duo aerial thing on a piece of apparatus that we call Bambook. I don't know. I haven't seen it in years.
What does
I don't
it
know
look like?
It's like a Chinese pole, okay, segment hanging. So it's just like a stiff pole, and then but it has
vertically hanging.
Hanging
by like one point, so the bottom is loose.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah. And then it has like foot hold pieces and hand loops. It's really a
it's old school. Awesome.
Yeah,
awesome.
I'd like, I should, now that I think about it and now that I realize how long it's been since I've seen anyone doing it, I'd like to see if that's still a thing or if people are still doing
it's like spinning ladder. It's like there's like a whole generation of like kinds of aerial acts that are kind of like novelty aerials.
Did you see it? We were at the Muse rehearsing for Slumber, and there was this girl there who had like basically a Chinese pole but hung by one point, and so the bottom was loose, and then a carousel horse on the bottom.
Sweet. Like, this sounds amazing.
It was. Like, oh my, but she had like just gotten it, so she didn't really know what to do with it yet. But, like, I would like to come back and see what you can do with that.
Right.
Just
years
ride the
later.
Horse.
Yeah.
It's a carousel horse.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That can be your next Smirkus.
But you didn't stay as long as you possibly could, right? Like, you finished when you were 16, or you, how?
Yes, I was, they had sort of, well, it was just a scheduling thing, really. I would have stayed, I finished in 2004, I was 16. I had already gotten into ENC.
At 16.
And you've gotten your GED too, right? Like you...
Well, I had to get my GED, because I got accepted into ENC. How did it work? No, I wasn't allowed to, if my memory serves me correctly, I wasn't allowed to audition without having a high school diploma. Mm-hmm. So I dropped out of high school at the beginning of my sophomore year in order to get my GED, in order to audition for ENC, got in that year. So I actually missed, in my last year of Smirkus, I had to miss the last few weeks. I was coming back on the weekends to start at ENC, and then the summer break after that just would never have allowed me to do that. The summer breaks were way too short. Although there is a part of me that thinks that would have been hilarious to be going to ENC and doing Smirkus in the summers. That would have been like a hilarious combination.
Yeah.
But it never worked out.
What was it like going through that program so much younger than, or at least on the younger end of that spectrum?
I think great. I think that was the perfect way to do that, because if I was even 18 or older, I think my focus would have lied elsewhere. I would have been way more about like socializing and partying and living that life. But as a 16-year-old, I was all about circus, and I was able to really commit to that and just do that all the time. By the time I had reached third year and I had grown up a bit, I was already starting to lose focus and be like, ugh, like, what is this school? And blah, blah, blah. So I had a hard time relating to the rest of the people there because they were adults, essentially.
Did you
adults.
Have fun when you were there, or was it like very like a focused, intensive, like sort of athletic training kind of attitude?
More that. Of course I had fun, but it really felt like a job in a way. I was like exceptionally focused and just wanted to like get through it and do it well. And
what did you audition for ENC with?
With Aerial Hoop. Because I had been doing it at Smirkus. I had my solo hoop act that year. Cheshire Cat.
Classic.
Cheshire Cat.
It was Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
Oh,
I was playing the Cheshire Cat.
Now you have the mustache to match.
Does the cat have a mustache? Oh, yeah. He has that kind of like lavender kind of like cat face.
Just dye it lavender. There you go.
That's a great idea.
Actually, that would be amazing.
I'm doing that. Yes. Hair,
you heard it here first.
Yeah, hair yellow, mustache lavender. It's going to be quite a look.
And you have the oatmeal nails.
Oh my God, they are chipped. They are so bad.
So you auditioned with Aerial Hoop.
I auditioned with Aerial Hoop. But my plan was to do silks. Mm-hmm. My plan was to do tissue at school. I wanted to do that full time. And when you audition, the year I auditioned, you had to tell them what your major was going to be at auditions, I think because they that way could schedule teachers and all of that. And the whole audition, this was on the last day, the whole audition, I was like, gonna put aerial silks. I wanna do that. This is what I'm doing. And then I got the form and then just had this moment of intense clarity where I realized if I choose silks and let's say I have an hour class, then I'm gonna spend half of that class climbing up, doing it, climbing down, it's going to be really inefficient. Whereas if I choose hoop, I'm immediately on it, doing the thing, coming down, versus like climb, 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 practice, climb down. So I was just like, oh my God. Basically, the laziness.
Sitting versus climbing.
Yeah, the laziness in me was like, oh, if I choose hoop, I can just be on it immediately the whole time. And then put hoop, and then you had to choose like two alternates.
Was there a guy who you saw hoop do who inspired you? Or because to me, like you, at least in my like personal references, are the beginning of seeing like men do flexible hoop with like a fair degree of like fast moving acro kind of tricks as well.
Yeah.
But is there somebody else who you saw do that and sort of inspired you? Or was
not
that...
not someone who is specifically male. I had just seen hoop done in a way that I loved, and I, you know, I had already been doing aerial of multiple sorts, and so I just saw. I wish I could remember who it was exactly, but maybe perhaps Kidam, the trio hoop girls in that, or something else. I think it was probably Kidam.
Because I think for people who haven't seen your number, I think the two things that really, or maybe three things that really stood out to me about it that make it special and different, and like why you've had such, I think why you've had such success with that number. Is A, just how flexible you are is amazing in it, and how like effortless that looks. But also like the rock star attitude you have. And I remember talking to you about that when you had just graduated and you picked the song. Do you remember what song you picked when you graduated ENC?
It was the Buggles. Radio. Yeah, it wasn't Video Killed the Radio Star, but it was the other single off of that album from the Buggles.
Because to me it was like, oh man, Brett made such a theatrical choice so early on. Because so many people who graduate from that school choose acts that are like very... They're talking about their own personal struggle of being at school or like being a teenager, and it's just all very like self-centered isn't the right idea word necessarily, angsty. But angsty and just like internal. The act is very, very internal. While the minute I saw you on stage, it was already so like I'm fucking here and present and like rock star vibe.
Right.
That I don't know, that really stuck with me. But was that something you were thinking about when you were at school and writing it?
Well,
just
I'll
part
tell
of-
you what's so funny is in my first year I did use Video Killed the Radio Star. Because I, at school, you do two kind of big presentations per year, one around Christmas to show your first term work, and then one around summer as you're finishing the year. And my very first one in December was exactly what you're describing. Like, this is what I'm struggling with. This is what this is about. And then coming up for the second one, I was trying to do that again. And just not really having a good time. I was really bummed out. And I received a great piece of advice from my roommate at the time who said, you know, just have fun. Remember what you love doing about this. Choose a song that you just love to dance to and have a great time with and make it fun. And I did that and it was so successful. I had such a good time. Teachers who had perhaps not even spoken to me that whole first year were coming up to me afterward like, that was incredible. Oh my God, you had, it looked so cool. And then all of my second year, I was going back to this really personal, intense, focused place. And then come third year, I was like, wait, I have to remember that was the best presentation I've done at school so far. It was just like crazy pop music, doing what I originally loved doing. Bringing in a sense, the smirkus attitude to it. Yeah. Like, let's just do it. And then it was so... kind of perfect for me. I was able to, and it's nice that you noticed that because I think, yeah, a lot of my feedback was exactly that, was just like, this was about you having a great time and loving being on stage versus like, I'm on stage, but I wish I wasn't here and I'm struggling with this, which can be a lot of people's attitude, perhaps.
Can be. Did you have like a lot of success booking you out of school, or was it difficult to get that act booked?
I was offered my first contract like a month before I graduated. I think we talked about this last night for a brief second. Yeah. I have flashbacks of that. So about a month before, my artistic counselor at school was hired as a choreographer for a new creation, which was happening in Switzerland. And she put me forward because a hoop girl dropped out. And then my artistic counselor put me in touch with the director and they offered me that. So in a sense, I had no trouble getting booked, but it wasn't booked for my own thing, my act that I had created. It was booked to create a new hoop act for the show. And I have never, ever
was
done
this
that.
Was this a Monty spinoff? I remember talking about it at the time. Or a Kinney spinoff?
It's one of the Kinney family members. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it's a spinoff. But no, it's it had existed in its own right for a long time. It's called the Sultanatale, which
is a Christmas show.
Yeah.
Yes, correct. Yeah. It was a Christmas show for many years. And then the year I got hired was their first time trying to go year round. So we got hired for 2 years to create a new show. And for the first time in Sultan Natalia's history, bring it outside of Switzerland. We were doing a European tour.
Is this your first time out of North America, or had you traveled to Europe before?
I had traveled to Europe a month before I started rehearsals for that show, and then was back in Europe 2 months later. But that was the first time.
Yeah.
I had gone to Sweden to visit my roommates from ENC who were Swedish.
And was it a good experience, that show?
Yes and no. It was a good experience for the following reasons. The cast was incredible. I learned so much about being an independent adult, earning my own living.
You were so young. You must have been like 18 or 19. I was in school when you were 16.
I landed in Switzerland to start the contract post rehearsals on my 19th birthday.
Dang.
Yeah, it was a bit. Oh, wait, hold up. Sorry. On my 20th birthday. Yes.
Well, in that case, that's impressive.
No, yeah, because I graduated. I was 19 when I graduated school and then landed on my 20th birthday in Switzerland to start that contract.
And you've never really moved back since?
And I've been living in Europe full time since then.
When did you meet Bertil, your husband?
two months before that in Sweden. So on my Swedish trip is when I met him. And then we were sort of dating long distance while I was in Switzerland. And the reason that I haven't left is because, and also, sorry, circling back to the bad things about the show, was the tour itself went terribly. My understanding was that they being Sultan Natale, had hired some European, marketing people, mm-hmm. publicists or something like that. I don't know what the correct word is of what these people were doing, but trying to sell the show outside of Switzerland for the first time.
Booking agents.
Yeah, but, yeah. Well, no, I mean, they had booked it. The tour was fully booked, but the people who had to sell the show.
Right. Marketing,
yeah. Putting up, getting crowds in. And so in Switzerland, where this company had a great name, we were selling fantastically. And the second we left Switzerland and our first stop was Luxembourg or Germany, sales were non-existent. And so the tour was terrible because as soon as we left Switzerland, we were playing the tent was enormous. It sat maybe 1,200 people.
Oh, wow.
And we were playing to crowds of 60, 70. Massive tent of nobody there. It was just miserable. So those were the downsides. And we ended up the tour ended up closing, going broke.
Mm-hmm.
And so they set us down on a Wednesday, and they're like, okay, this time next Wednesday, we're flying you all home. Tour's over in a week from now. And another castmate of mine, who's a lot more clever than me at the time, was quick enough to raise his hand and ask, which home are you describing? The apartment I lived in 9 months ago that I have gotten rid of, or the car that I sold to move to Europe for 2 years? And this is 9 months into a 2-year contract. And so after they thought about it and came back to us the following day, okay, we'll fly you wherever you want. So some people I think went to, the Bahamas, and some people went to their parents' house, or, no one had anything. We had sold everything to move to Europe. And I was already I'd gotten engaged to Bertil by that time. So I just was like, okay, fly me to London. I'll stay with him until I figure out what's going on, and then haven't left London since.
Yeah. So let's talk about the London scene for a little bit, because I hung out with you there and I saw you in a few different places. But I think London is both very, very similar to New York in the sense that it's got a similar amount of cabaret kind of clubs and similar spaces. There's a box here, there's a box there. But I think the culture for a circus in London is much stronger. At least it was 2 or 3 years ago. They have more than one school, legit school. But what was it like being there? And what's the difference between the London scene versus the US scene, or the English attitude towards circus?
I can't describe you the difference, I think, because I'm so out of touch with the American circus scene.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a culture in London, and I am in no way the expert on this at all. But what I can sort of gather is that there's a culture for going out to see shows in London that aren't just the West End or Broadway shows. Mm-hmm. people will go out and check out anything going on. So there is a lot of space for small cabarets. Also, they just love, I think they just love the cabaret style of going in and seeing polished numbers lined up back to back. That's very successful there. I wish I knew why. I have no idea.
So did you meet Brett Haylock and become involved with La Soirée while you were in London?
No, in Montreal. That's so funny. You can't write how weird real life ends up and like how strange this all works out. But if I can try to tell this story as concisely as I can, this is a great story. A friend of mine, the one who recommended me for this podcast, Joe Pinzon, guested in La Clique in summer of 2006 because he was replacing an aerialist in that show who got injured. So Joe Pinzon, Gypsy Snyder had recommended Joe Pinzon as a replacement aerialist. So he guested in that show. He invited me to see his premiere in that. I immediately, just like Circus Workers, was immediately like, I have to be in this. This is exactly where I need to be. And then I had met Brett Haylock for, I don't know, 5 minutes or something. Then the following summer, also in summer of 2006, I then, after saw his premiere, was sneaking into like every show they did. I knew where the smoking area was, so I'd wait for people like staff or cast to come out and smoke. And then as the door was closing, I would sort of slip my foot in and just walk into the back of the Just for Last Museum and watch the show essentially every night, like just stand by the bar. I think they were in town for 2 weeks for the Just for Last Festival. And I was like, this is amazing. And then the following summer, I called Brett Haylock right when I got back from Sweden before I started rehearsals for Salto de Tale, which rehearsed in Montreal, and just called him and I essentially said, put me in one night guest spot. I will do it for free. Put me in. Give me one chance. You won't regret it. Like, really? I would never be that bold now. But at the time, I was just so determined that's where I needed to be. Put me in this. And he finally let me. And it was their closing night in Montreal the second year for the Just for Last Festival. I went in on the closing night, guested. He'd already booked another guest spot, so they had two guests in that night. I did it for free. And this story. Woo. And in that, if this is interesting, should I keep going? Is this interesting?
Yeah.
That when I guested, I met another performer in the show, Misbehave. Met her just in the way that we were backstage. I was like, oh, hello, I'm Brett. Then the night in Switzerland, the Wednesday night when they told us we were all losing our job next week, the whole cast was like, let's go out and just like drink this into oblivion. Went out that night in Berlin is where we were when they told us that. Went out to this hilarious bar in Berlin called The White Trash and had like a bunch of drinks in me and ran into Misbehave. And I was like, hey, how are you? So good to see you. And she was like, oh my gosh, what are you doing here? Blah, blah, blah. You know, she was like, oh, I loved your act. I thought it was so incredible. I was like, oh, that's so funny. I just lost my job. Like, that's so funny. Like, I don't know what's happening. And she was like, oh, what do you mean you lost your job? I was like, yeah, like this time next week, we're all getting flown out of Berlin. And I guess I'm going to London. She's like, oh, actually I'm doing a show in London. I'm doing a 3-week run at the Roundhouse called Misbehave's Variety Nighty. Let's get you in there. Went in, did that, and La Clique was at Edinburgh Festival at the time, and Brett Haylock came down for a night, saw me in her show, was sort of reminded who I was and how that went, and then offered me a job in La Clique later that same year.
That's amazing. I just saw her game show in New York.
Oh, did
like,
you?
Two
did
or
you?
3 weeks ago.
Did you love it?
Yeah, I loved it. It's so good. I mean, the only problem is that they gave her like less than an hour or two to book it, so she had to like fly through the whole ending of the show because they didn't give her like a long enough time slot. But it was really, really smart. Just the whole, all the premise in the games is just so clever.
I think. Was Harriet in the show?
Is Harriet like
her like little camp assistant?
Yes.
He was in the show.
Yeah,
he was in the show. Right. I had understood that he was.
Or at least
able
there was a guy in drag who was like sort of a campy assistant who's.
Oh. I think it I was a different if, one. Yeah, I think it was. I don't remember his name. But she'd been working with this guy called. He goes by Harriet in the show, and when she does the UK runs, and he is just hilarious, and the rapport between the two of them is just so fun to watch.
So Brett Haylock saw you in that and was like, all right, come join us.
Yeah, he had remembered. He's like, oh yeah, like that was fun having you guest in London. And now I've seen the act had developed and changed a lot by then. And he was like, this looks great. And they opened the London season later that year. I didn't open the season, but at the same time, they decided to open a French season as a sort of trial for Paris. And then, so half of the cast had to go to France. And then I came into the London run to replace some of the cast who had gone to France. And I think he called me on New Year's Eve. I was in Sweden doing a show on New Year's Eve. And as I finished the show, he called me. There was like fireworks were starting like any second now. It was like 11:30 p.m. On New Year's Eve. And he was like, I'd love to have you in the show. I was like, oh, I'm in Stockholm. He's like, okay, like the first show's on the 2nd. Like, so just fly back tomorrow and let's like get it in there the day after. And it's all very like rush, rush, rush. And now I've been with the company for almost 9 years.
Amazing. I think I've seen you do it 3 times, maybe, in that show.
All in New York?
No.
London.
At least one in London, maybe 2 in London.
I saw you once.
I brought my dad
New York. To see
it. But I think when you brought your father to London, I don't think I was in the show. I think I watched it with you guys.
Well, maybe you did. Did we sit in the back together?
I think so. Times? Yeah, I think I wasn't in that season.
So what kind of things did you learn while you were there? Because, I mean, it seems like La Soirée is the most amazing place to be hanging out and meeting, like, the best variety artists in the world, particularly, like, with Frodo, whose act you now, do. I don't know if that's the right way of describing it. But
yeah, sort of. I'm sort of understudying it. Yeah,
understudying it.
The biggest gift I have taken from working with this company is the gift of I learned how to meet people who I normally wouldn't have given the time of day beforehand. They're like, you know, so it's like, oh, like my act is I like, in Misbehave's case, like, oh, I like put a rubber glove on my head and like inflate it with my nose. If some before that, being from circus school, if I was not coming, I would have been like, okay, whatever. But then I was able to like meet these people and be like, oh my gosh, your craft is so well perfected. This is incredible. I love everything about it. And like learn to recognize that talents lie in so many places other than like being able to do great splits.
Yeah.
and I have really adopted that into my practice now to be like, oh, it's okay if I don't touch the hoop for 12 minutes because I can do all this other crazy stuff. And as something as simple as, you know, drinking a coffee can be an entire act if you have perfected it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I remember talking to you maybe 2 or 3 years ago and you're telling me sort of how you were sort of like, I wouldn't say frustrated isn't necessarily the right word, but like sort of looking for something else other than just the hoop act that you were doing at the time to like sort of artistically challenge yourself and like, you know, fulfill your sort of artistic side. And recently you've been doing this Frodo comedy act, which is, as far as I know, the first time you've done like basically a clown number.
Right? Oh, entirely the first time.
Do you want to explain who Frodo is?
So Captain Frodo is an incredible performer. He started in the sort of sideshow street scene and now has what he's most known for is this long form kind of half stand up clowning comedy number where he's
contortion number.
He goes by the Incredible Rubber Man and sort of contorts himself through 2 tennis rackets on stage, but it's just like a laugh a minute riot. For
it's a laugh every second, right?
Sorry, yeah, it's multiple laughs per second, I think you'll find. But I was, when I was talking to you, I was just like, I just want to do comedy. Like, I had met all these comedians, and I was like, it looks so rewarding to like go upstage and have people respond to your jokes. And so I think at the time, I was like, you know, I've been doing this hoop thing, but I just want to do comedy, but I don't want to do comedy hoop, I just want to do comedy another way. And I was sort of exploring that, and it worked out that Frodo. Sorry, this is so funny that right when I said the word Frodo, there's a book behind you that says Fodors, which is a perfect anagram of Frodo. And I spotted that right at the same time I said that. That is so bizarre. Weird.
Yeah. Well,
we'll make a reference to it in the cover photo.
Like, this is weird. What are the chances?
And then we have Bertle.
Oh, yeah, look at that. There's my husband.
I told you, I wasn't lying.
I didn't think you were lying.
I did tell Brett, though, that I was like, I joked. It was a joke. But I was like, oh, yeah, I love Bertel's photography book because Bertel is an amazing photographer. I was like, I just looked at it yesterday.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. You're like, we've had it for years. I decided to glance through it yesterday.
I'm hilarious.
What was that like, though, learning his act? Are you the first person to do it besides him?
I am. A little backstory on that is that the way this came to be was that a few different people in the La Soirée extended family had started, for lack of a better word, franchising their act to other people. When they couldn't do seasons, or if their multiple seasons worked at the same time, they would find someone, much like Anatoly Zolievsky's model, where he made that beautiful act and then taught a bunch of people to do it well.
We talked to Jordan about doing David's act too, 2 episodes ago.
Exactly.
I guess you could say licensing the act, right?
Yes, licensing the act, and exactly. And Frodo and I were living together during a Paris run of La Clique. It was actually the last La Clique run before they changed their name.
To La Soirée.
And we were living together, and he was like, oh, like, everyone's starting to do this sort of act licensing, and it's a shame I'll never be able to do that, because you have to be able to dislocate and do all these crazy things with your body that is not something that people can actually do. And I was like, that's so funny, because I always watch your act. I'm like, it's so weird that I can do all that. And then we had this like eye moment where we looked at each other like, wait a minute. And then we didn't actually turn this into a reality until earlier this year, which that was 2010. And so now, in beginning of 2016, 6 years later, was we actually started working on it.
How did you guys start working on it? How did you learn those things without an audience, or like just get the timing and things?
Because he is an incredible coach, director, and mentor. He knows that act so well that even when if the props are entirely different, if it rather than a stool it's a chair, and rather than a mic stand it's like a box with a microphone on it, he'll nail it. He'll figure out exactly how to make it all perfect. Anytime. So he was able to look at me completely fresh and find out my path through the act in a really...
He must have had so much fun with that, being able to watch it on somebody else.
I think he did. And we're still having a great time with it. So we're still... Yeah, we're still booking gigs. So I've only done it in front of an audience now maybe maximum 15 times since February. It was just us going on stage during the day and with the equipment, and him being like, try this. How does this work? Okay, that's not working. So let's find a new thing. That's
how did it feel the first time you talked on stage?
Terrifying. And the first time, so what our La Soirée during festivals will often do a thing called Club Soirée, which is like an after show. They take the chairs out and invite people in and do, it's kind of like a trial. Like someone's going to try this new thing, or we're going to see what this looks like. And so we had planned for the end of Perth Fringe for the last night Club Soirée. I was going to do the act, and as we planned for, but turns out that night, like almost everyone at Club Soirée had just seen the full length La Soirée show. So 80% of the audience had just seen Frodo do it like an hour earlier. And then I came out like, hey, it's me. Ready to see what you just saw, but way less good? Here we go. Buckle up. Here's 13 minutes of what you just saw, but not as good. Yeah, it was terrifying. It stresses me out so much more than doing my hoop act.
Yeah.
Like, just like, okay, because there's no... In hoop, there's things I can, if I'm lost or confused about the act, there's things I can go to. I'm like, this will definitely get a rise of them. I'm like, oh, wait till you see this split. And when I'm on stage with a microphone, it's like, I have no fallback. It's like, I have to land this or it doesn't land at all.
Yeah, it's one of the things we're talking to Spencer about when we were creating Lee's character, because Spencer wasn't here for it originally, for that creation process, is this
Lee
idea.
Lee
in Slumber, sorry, our psycho killer in Slumber, for those who haven't seen it. It's this idea of having like a safety net in comedy. So sort of the way you're talking about with the splits of like, okay, well, we know if this joke doesn't work, like at least we can just go back to this. Mm-hmm. But sort of like you doing that for the first time, or the beginning of creating a character, the lack of safety net is such a scary thing for the performer on stage, being like, well, it's just me talking and I haven't done this at all yet. So I don't even know if like none of this is working. I don't even have things to fall back on to use because it's all new.
The first week of shows. Material. It was, you know, Lee figuring out what worked and what didn't. And it was like a joke and then a big silence, you know, and you're like, all right, well, I just have to keep going or else the show is going to just stop.
Yeah.
And I imagine that being just like
stressful.
I think, well, no, I don't think, I know that Frodo does have a bunch of fail safes. He knows if something so's not working, he knows exactly where to jump to later in the act to make that happen. And I'm still not familiar enough with the act to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And if and when a joke goes wrong, my instinct, which is the wrong one, is to rush to the next thing that I know is a joke. Mm-hmm. And then I just end up jumbling it all because then I'm just rushing. And then the next one falls flat. So I'm like, rush the next thing. And then I'm basically just racing through the act. And this act, which is supposed to take me 12 and a half minutes, sometimes takes me like 9 minutes. Because I'm like, ah, it's next thing, rushing through. And it's just...
Right.
Yeah.
Has it made you want to create your own comedy act? Like, how has this experience sort of opened your mind up?
I've always wanted to create my own comedy act, but it has actually made it more daunting now that I see how much work and struggling with that would be. And I don't want to become like a cynical comedian who's like, oh God, I have to think about comedy all day and talk to everyone I meet about comedy. It's like, shut up. So I'm happy just doing this, and I want to spend years getting this right. I want to really perfect that, because if I could ever perform it half as good as Frodo does, that would be a huge achievement for me, because he does it just... It's just so perfect. I mean, I've been watching the act for, like I said, almost a decade now, watching it on stage, and I still genuinely laugh all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen the amount. I've probably seen it 20 times, maybe that number, and it goes down as, one of, I think, just the best variety acts of all time, and for sure one of them, of like a current living variety act. But there's so much in it. You can watch it a decade and still be like, oh man, that works so well, that's still so funny. But also something different from comedy and from movie, you've also been doing directing, which I want to talk to you about. And I know you guys started out directing school shows, which to me seems like probably the best, most practical way to start. But I wonder if you can talk about your sort of directing and creating career as well.
So in that, let me start with, yes, starting with school shows, I was hired to direct the third year end of year group show for Code Arts in Rotterdam, Code Arts Circus.
That's a circus school in Rotterdam.
It's a circus school in Rotterdam. Well, Code Arts is a large performing arts university that does music and dance and a whole sort of things. And they recently have added a exclusively circus school unit. And it's quite new. I want to say it's 10 or 11 years old, something like that. Oh my gosh. I don't have the information in front of me. Don't quote me on that. But it's a fresh school in the European circus school scene. And directed that. And my approach to directing is I'm just obsessed with very detailed quality of movement, which is actually why I think I responded so well to Slumber. I mean, just the attention to detail and the movement specifically in the most part of the show is so exactly what I love. And yes, directing a school show is the exact perfect way to start, in my opinion, because it's absolutely no risk. You don't not have to sell any tickets. There's no financial risk at all. And it's a school, so even if the process is going terribly and the result is garbage, there's a learning process to be had. You can learn what you hate as well. And so it feels no pressure. You know, I don't feel responsible to the cast. I can very much just go in and do my own thing. And I feel like anything I do right or wrong becomes a learning experience.
Yeah, but you're just not paying them, which is a good reason for that.
Yeah.
You know? They're there to learn from you in a way, while when it's a regular gig, it's like they're there to do the gig and get paid and go.
Well, I think they're there to learn from the experience, not from me.
But also, they're like, okay, how is it like working with a director, period?
Exactly. You know? But they're not learning from... I'm not like, let me impart my knowledge onto you. It's more like, let's do this and let's try to make it awesome. And then they can learn from the experience of that. And what's also cool about doing that is if you are brought in as a school director, or I can only speak for Code Arts, I haven't directed any other school shows, but... at no point are they like sitting down like, okay, here's some of the curriculum you need to pass on. It's none of that. It's literally just like, go for it, do your thing. And the school, you know, this is me talking as a school, like, we're here to back you. like, we're here to just support you in any way. Tell us what you need. We'll try to make it happen. And it was just incredible. Yeah. So then I did that and then was hired again to do it the following year.
Then you and I have been talking about directing as well, and you have other things you want to do as far as that goes.
Yeah. It feels like the natural evolution from performing, just because I, as you know, Josh, am exceptionally critical of everything I see. I have a lot of opinions. And so it seems like the natural thing to do is be like, well, this is how I want to do it right. This is how I want it to look.
One of the interesting things that Joe was talking about on his episode was going from the process of being hypercritical, and now that he's directed stuff, he feels like worse about being hypercritical because he's gone through the experience of like, of creating a show and then going, oh, like, I agree, like, I don't like about, even though I'm responsible for these choices, and I feel this way about Slumber as well, like, I agree, I don't like these certain things. And leaving a show now, I no longer feel like, oh, I don't get why the director didn't fix that. And now I'm almost like, I bet the director's also unhappy with that piece of their work as well.
100%. What it has opened my eyes to is realizing when I see a show, the thousands of reasons that I don't know about. Knowing right. that there's so many things. I have no idea why this has to be like this. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how this came to be, but there's probably thousands of unseen reasons that I don't know. Where in the past I was like, you know, the director could do whatever they want and make it all perfect. It's like, no, like, so-and-so needs a break at a right. certain time in the show.
Or it's like you've given the same note to a performer a bajillion fucking times and they won't take it.
Right.
So then you're just like, all right, well, I'm just going to live with that.
Yeah, exactly.
I know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
But it's also, sorry, made me even more hypercritical. It's like done both. It's made me less critical of some people's work. And when stuff is like really, really bad, then I'm even more critical of it. I'm like, come on, you couldn't fix any
you know,
of this.
I'm the most critical now about going through a creation of a circus show that has no text or basis to stand on, like a script of like a musical or a play. When I see a play or a musical that sucks because like the direction's just really terrible, I'm like, you had this whole plethora of like knowledge to draw from, you know? It's like a circus show. You're literally like creating the foundation as you go. And so I think I'm a lot more open to problems in like a creation of a circus show rather than like a play. So
right.
play, I'm like, you have this text that you know, years especially a revival, but
yeah.
you know this show works because
yeah.
it's revived.
Yeah.
And now it's still bad because of the direction's just terrible.
Right, yeah.
So I think I'm both. I'm also like a real bitch, like theater girl.
No, but yeah, in circus, more often than not, you are literally creating from nothing, and you have to
yeah.
you have to every choice belongs to the
someone.
Director or someone. Yeah, the director or someone in the cast versus receiving a script, which is someone else's main choices, and you have
right.
to sort of. Fill in the blanks.
The difference between the actor and the circus performer is very interesting because the circus performer has the creator in it. You know, you got to work with their vocabulary and like what they bring to it. While the actor's like, you got to fit into this role.
Yeah.
One of the things I talked to Sebastian about, and I must imagine that you struggle with, is the guy aerialist booking in general seems to be like maybe the hardest genre of act.
This is a conversation for off mic in which I like tell you about my newfound responsibility towards gender identity. But
I think it has to be off line, as you will. I think it's an interesting...
But Joe Pinzon talked about it, and talked to Sebastian about it. Like, there must be such an internal struggle of knowing, of managing that balance of being like, I'm just not getting booked for Hoop specifically because I'm a dude and I'm not like a little girl.
I don't have that experience because I get booked for Hoop all the time.
Yeah.
Sorry, that sounds really pompous, but there's no point where I'm like, oh, I really wish I had not. I'm just working constantly. But what I am absolutely so sick of seeing, and this I get, so ENC does these casting emails out, like we get one like every couple of weeks just because people contact them anyway. So if you're an alumni,
mm-hmm.
if you're an alumnus, you receive these casting emails. And so frequently, like literally at least one in every single email will say, blah, 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 circus show requires the following. One female aerialist, any discipline. One male floor acrobat, any discipline. What? It looks to me like you're looking for an aerialist and an acrobat. Without having seen any of these shows, I can't imagine that of the hundreds of casting calls I've received that it's really important which genitals each of these performers has. Yeah, and it's all the time. Seeking female aerialist and male ground acrobat.
Well, I think I know what that is, but why do you think that is?
Because people are stuck in this sort of heteronormative, like, we need pretty girls in the air and men who look strong on the floor. And this is the only way it works in my mind. And I'm completely unable to see past that. That's how what I think it is. It's like, girls, like, flowy, graceful, beautiful. And also this sort of held onto belief, like, girls are graceful, and that's how, so we need graceful air, and men are brutish and can bounce well.
Can bounce well?
Yeah.
Like acrobats.
Like acrobats can, like, throw themselves
in the air. I, like, have the image of a dude, like, just bouncing on his ass on the floor. Like, bouncing well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it also comes down to, like, the amount of people who cast for circus who know anything about it are, like, maybe work for, like, 4 or 5 legit companies, and that's about it. Like, I think a lot of people just go, like, all right, we got our cruise ship gig coming up. Like, let's book.
Yeah.
Book some acts. And, like, in
cruise
their head,
ships
they're like, okay,
well,
this. Girls do fabric and dudes do dudes do that. And, like, let's go find those people.
You're right. And then the relic of that thought on the page is just writing female aerialist. Rather than writing graceful aerialist, this is a casting call I could respond to. Seeking graceful aerialist with beautiful lines, which... you're probably right, is more often than not going to be a woman because that's how it has been traditionally. But that is a call which describes the role. I don't get it.
Yeah.
Or I totally get it. I just don't agree with any of it.
Right.
But it sounds like I have this big chip on my shoulder about it. And I think others might. But it's actually, I don't have it to my shoulder based on me not getting work. I have it just based on, like, the gender struggle that's happening all around us all the time, which I am just very recently awoken to. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my God. Like, oh, so I'm really obsessed with that right now. I'm like a very newfound feminist and, like, really
into
it all of a sudden.
Yeah, that's a big piece of summer for us, is talking about how, like, a lot of the ensemble shows in circus are, like, 6 dudes and 1 girl. You know, it's, like, literally the opposite problem. And going, like, okay, like, we can... Jorn's the one flyer in the show. Jorn gets caught by, like, 6 girls, which I don't think I've ever seen in a show before. And so I have Lindsay and I talking about, like, how do we both make that choice and make it not seem like a choice simultaneously. Mm. I mean, I think circus is going through a very interesting period right now, particularly as that's happening. One of the things about Jorn is just... also, like, apparently it's a thing in the Australian scene. It's a big question about this. Is, like, all these dudes, because it's a lot of acro in Australia mm-hmm. versus aerials, all these dudes, like, being the ones who throw these, like, little girl around. And mm-hmm. that's because there's so many people who do that, it's the foundation of so many shows, and then just becomes the norm through almost nobody choosing it to be the norm, but just by virtue of, like, the way the whole system, the system works, the show creation system. I'm curious to know what you think, but it's definitely, circus is in a weird moment for it right now.
In response to that, I just wanted to say I am entirely guilty of this way of thinking as well. 100%. When I directed my first Code Arts show, it was a show I wrote about a group of witches battling a group of humans. This was the whole idea behind it. And as soon as I sort of got the idea in my head and sort of started writing it down on paper, immediately I was like, well, it's going to be a group of female witches and a group of human dudes. Definitely, because, like, I want these, like, strong, powerful... I had just seen American Horror Story Coven. This, like, super powerful group of female witches. Yeah. And I was, like, totally obsessed with that whole idea. And then only in talking to my husband about the show as he was, like, why it gotta be divided by gender? And then I sort of had this, like, oh, my God, you're right. That's absurd. Like, I am exactly all of these people who like, I'm exactly that person. Because me, I know it's very often, it's very popular amongst, I'm doing sweeping generalizations now, but it's very popular amongst gay men to have women look a very specific way, like high heels, beautiful makeup, put together impeccably. And I wanted all of that, too. I was like, I just want these women to just, like, look like these amazing women. And I was like, wait, that's so unnecessary. I can, and it will be a much richer show if... people in the show get to choose whether they're witch or human and how that relates to them. And we had a much better time doing that.
So your tattoos.
Oh,
you have a lot of them.
Excellent segue.
Well, I did want Brett to strip down last night so I could see all of his tattoos.
Oh, yeah, that was going to be a thing. Maybe maybe when we're done here.
But you can't see, but Brett is just covered.
Yes, I am almost... I'm getting very close to full coverage here. As what happens with a lot of people who get tattooed, like, you get one, it's kind of, you get the hook for it. You're like, oh, I'm into this. It has sort of its own hold on you. But as a performer, I started with a couple subtle ones thinking like, oh, I'll put this under costumes. And then finally I was just too into tattoos that I was like, I just need one bold one. And I got these things here on my ribs on both sides. And then at that point it's like, okay, these cannot be hidden anymore. So I just said like, let's go all in. Let's start going with it. And now, as I was saying last night, now a lot of my bookings revolve around the tattoos. Like, and it's this funny thing where now it's like more tattoos, less costume. It's like this is becoming the costume,
yeah.
And that's just been a funny, cool thing where people now I'm getting booked for my tattooed look, which also is, you know, need tattooed male for show. It's like, well. Okay, need tattooed person for sure. anyway, that's the...
Can you talk a little bit about your tattoo philosophy? Because at one point I was talking to you about, like, you didn't like shading at the time and sort of, like, aesthetic choices you made with your tattoos.
Well, it's just... Well, my main thing is what I don't like, and this is entirely personal, I want everyone to have the exact tattoos they want, of course. But, especially for someone who takes all their clothes off on stage all the time and is almost entirely naked on stage for most of my career now, I just needs to all look well planned and thought out. And what I don't respond to is mixing of styles. When you have like a handful of different styles, they don't work together much as how often you don't like mix like decades in fashion or obscene colors and patterns. That's
how would you describe your tattoo aesthetic or general design for somebody who can't see it?
Entirely black line symmetry. I'm almost perfectly symmetrical, left to right, black lines exclusively.
Yeah. It's cool.
It's very cool.
I was talking to Brett last night. I asked, I really want a tattoo. It's like, I just want like a little thing on my hand. He's like, oh, you and every 19-year-old girl. He's like, go big. And I was like, no. I was like, I really respect your opinion, but no.
Go big or go home.
I'm going to stick to my 19-year-old.
The cooler thing now, and actually this is a conversation I have a lot with people who are very heavily tattooed, is the sort of white whale, if you will, now is meeting people with no tattoos. Yeah. And it's like, ooh, like there's nothing on you. That's so cool. Hold on to that. Much like people who are adults who've never tried McDonald's.
Right.
Or adults who have never seen Star Wars. It's like, seriously, it's like this whole, like, it's like a special kind of person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, obviously there are loads of people that are not tattooed, but in my circle, especially in the performing cabaret kind of freak show scene, everyone's got at least a couple. Or one small one on their finger.
Next time you see him, I'm going to be like, hey, Brad. And wave my hand in front of you.
So I want to start wrapping up, but usually ask the same sort of set of questions to people.
Great.
But my favorite one that we've been asking a lot recently, has there been a piece of advice that somebody has given you, good or bad, that has stuck with you?
Two huge ones that stick with me a lot. The first one we already said is when my roommate at the time was like, don't think about what other people want. Have fun and do what you want. Super important. And then the other is from a guy, a director, and he works as an artistic counselor at ENC called Alain Francard. And he said to me, while I was doing a creation with him once in my first or second year of school, focus on the hands, because so many people, I think especially a lot of choreographers, or let me not generalize, a lot of people will focus on the body, and then this detail is either left up to chance or just the same, like a sort of wash of this is the hands the entire time. And Alain really got me thinking about hands. And often just by thinking about hands, it also changes your entire body.
Yes.
So it's a piece of advice I follow really religiously. And one of my favorite teaching tools when someone's like, how does this look? And I just, without telling them what to do at all, I just say, think about what your hands are doing. And then it just changes it so much, especially people who are in the air, who a lot of the times are holding on by their hand. So when their hand is free, how are you releasing the equipment and coming back to it? Mm. And if you have seen my act recently, it's a hand show. I'm like, look at these hands. Give me more hands.
That's probably another reason why you liked the choreography in Slumber, because Kiyo and Mari are obsessed with hands. And when we auditioned like 100 dancers, I was like, oh, she's so good. And Mari was like, her hands aren't good.
Yeah.
Hands aren't good.
It is 100% the first and last thing I notice on every act. I'm totally obsessed with hands.
Has there been a show that you've seen at some point in your life that really just changed your experience of circus, or one that you would recommend to people who are getting into circus?
The most impactful show I've ever seen, well, in the most impactful specifically circus show was the run of Loft that opened the Tohu, because it was...
Loft being a Seven Fingers.
Loft by the Seven Fingers. But when they did the Tohu run, they had altered Loft in a way which was specific to Tohu, which was they brought in a bunch of guest performers on stage with them. So acts that traditionally in Loft were solos became duos or trios. Mm. And they were using the space in a way I had never seen. They had performers planted all around the room. And they were using sound in an incredible way, and they were interacting in a way I had never experienced before. And like when I had seen La Clique later, I was like, I need to see the show every night of the run. I need to be in here all the time. And luckily I was sort of half dating someone working out at the time. So I was just in there a lot. I needed to see the show. Like it ran for, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks. I was like, I need to be here as much as possible. Mm. And then the most formative show I saw outside of circus is Mary Chouinard's piece, Body Remix, The Goldberg Variations. Mary Chouinard is a Montreal-based choreographer who does dance shows. And that show, obsessed with hands. Like, she started using hands in this way that was just so absurd to me. She does a lot of this shape, which I will describe to the listener.
Like a beak?
Sort of like, yeah, like pushing your fingers together and making like a beak, and was using wrists and changing the angles of these kind of hooked hands in an incredible
way.
Your hands
look so nice doing it. Mine look like fat little sausages. Like
years of practice, darling. Years of practice. And she was doing, and yeah, just like doing movement, which traditionally I would have found really ugly, but using it in such a unique way that I... So those are the two sort of most formative shows, I would say. Mm.
Is there somebody you'd recommend we interview for this podcast?
That's a question I knew you were going to ask me. And I spent the past like 24 hours being like, who's the perfect person to recommend? And I came into this recording having no one in mind, and realized now through talking, the person you should talk to is Captain Frodo. He's just an incredible performer and machine. In the best way. He is like a comedy machine. He can crank out new ideas and new thoughts on stuff. And he's amazing.
That's such a nice dude, too.
And an absolute pleasure to talk to.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely have to have him on at some point.
I wanted to fly to... He was working in a show called Circus Nemo in Denmark a few months ago. And I was like, I need to go. I sort of was saying, I need to go to Denmark to see him. As a sort of a catch-up rehearsal or like a maintenance rehearsal. And in the 11th hour, just didn't bring any props and just made it into a vacation with Frodo for 2 days. Like, let's just hang out. And it'll just be enough just watching him do his act again, just refreshing my memory to him doing it. And that was plenty. I mean, we could have done more, but it was just, I just wanted to hang out with him.
Awesome. Well, Brett, thank you so much for coming to the podcast.
Thanks, Brett.
I hated it.
And that was the show.
And our interview with Brett Pfister. If you enjoyed it, go on Facebook, like us, Instagram, follow us, Twitter, tweet us, write us an email, hello@howtowaycircus.com. Let us know what you think of the show, if you have any guest suggestions. Are you going to come see us in Australia?
Yeah, come see us in Australia, February 16th and March 19th. Have a good week, and I hope you voted.
Me too.
We're with her.